In German, dick means fat. So, Ratman's exercise binge was caused by the subconscious desire to get rid of fat, which really was masking his real desire to get rid of his cousin. Now, if you let these fierce battles below the subconscious rage, they will find a way to the surface in an unhealthy fashion. So, it's important to figure out how we can release the pressure. Enter humor. Suppose we took every single joke made by humans in all of human history and grouped them. What would be the two biggest groups? Far and away, it would be dirty jokes and ethnic jokes. Freud thinks this should tell us something. He terms these types of humor to be tendentious jokes. Why are we so drawn to tendentious jokes? Freud argues that it's because they serve a very important function. They can be used to relieve the pressure building up in the war between the id and the superego and save the mind from an internal rupture. The two most common urges we experience from the id that are suppressed by the superego are sexual desires and violent impulses against those who are different from us. We live in cultures that are full of ethnic and gender diversity. The first leads us to want to bang on someone, and the second, just to bang them. But we are cultured beings. Neither of those is the sort of thing a respectable person like us would even entertain. We are better than that. And so the pressure builds and builds and builds. It needs to be released before it gives rise to neurotic behaviors. But how? The interesting thing about tendentious jokes is that they're just words, not actions. The superego is on patrol, staked out at the front door of the mind, making sure you do not act on these impulses. But the jokes are not doing. They're only saying. It means that it comes through the back door where the superego is not on guard. Dirty jokes may be titillating. Ethnic jokes might be aggressive. But the titillation and the aggression are not really expressed since you never actually do anything. It's a safe way to act without acting. And this helps give you release from the pent-up repressed desires you don't want to act on and, indeed, might even not want to admit you really even feel. The best Freudian joke I ever wrote. Why did the Freudian chicken cross the road? It was envious of the cock. It takes the old comedic Saul, the chicken crossing the road joke, but uses it to make a pun-based reference to the Freudian theory of penis envy. It's a slightly dirty joke and thereby allows us to vent some pent-up sexual frustration in a safe way that allows us now to be less likely to feel the need to act upon such a horrible need. The Freudian approach to mind fell out of favor with the professional psychological community in the 1970s, once imaging technology allowed us access to the brain. At this point, a more mechanistic, neuroanatomical picture has come to dominate the field. With the rejection of the Freudian picture of mind, so went the advocates of Freud's version of the relief theory. But the view is not without its contemporary advocates. Robert Latta, for example, has worked to reformulate relief theory for a post-Freudian intellectual world. Latta contends that humor is a psychological phenomenon that occurs in three distinct but necessary phases. Latta's first phase is being in a state of cognitive unrelaxation. We need to feel bothered in order to experience humor. If you're continually relaxed, then there can be no humor. Humor requires you to leave your normal state of being and find yourself in a place where you're confused by something. Jokes require a setup and a punchline. If you simply told someone the setup to a joke, there would be absolutely no humor at all. It's not until the listener has also heard the punchline and finds him or herself in that odd position of cognitive distress of not understanding how this new, incompatible bit of information can be fit into my knowledge structure with the primary interpretation of the setup. The second stage of humor is getting the joke. Latta refers to this as mid-process transition. The brain does work, which results in a cognitive shift, a change of viewpoint, what's long been referred to as a gestalt switch. The brain does not know which of these viewpoints to hold until it realizes that one of them, the new one, makes sense of everything. All the pieces that we couldn't figure out how to fit together suddenly dovetail perfectly with this new perspective. Like Hutchison, Lotta contends that the restoration of order gives us great emotional relief. But we had all the tension from the first stage. Where does it go? Again, just as in Hutchison's version, it escapes the body through laughter, which brings with it a return to the initial state of relaxation. We like being relaxed, especially if it follows stress of some sort. We enjoy coming inside and enjoying a nice hot mug of cocoa after dealing with the cold. We enjoy the air conditioning after sweating it out in the heat. A state of mental distress allows us to more fully appreciate relaxation. That's why we love jokes. Relieving ourselves feels good. Sorry, went back to Freud there for a moment. Do all philosophers buy relief theory? Of course not. We're philosophers. If we all agreed on things, we'd be out of a job and have to get real work. Here are several arguments against relief theory in general and specific versions in particular. Against relief theory as a class of views, philosophers have pointed out that this should not even be thought of as a theory of humor, but rather as a psychological explanation for what happens in the mind when we find something funny. This is not a philosophical explication of the notion of humor, but rather an attempt at a scientific account of why the mind finds things amusing. The two are different. And what we want in our quest is the first, but what they give us is the second. Another argument against relief theory in general is that not all humor causes relief. Sometimes the effect of humor is, and is intended to be, increasing tension in the listener. Consider two examples. The first are humorous insults. Now, if I thought you were not very bright, I could just say, "Man, are you stupid?" No humor there, and you'd surely be insulted. Or I could express the same sentiment humorously. "You know, if brains were magnets, we couldn't stick you to the front of the refrigerator." That's clearly a different sort of utterance than, "Man, you're stupid." It's a humorous insult. But if you were the person being insulted, the fact that it's humorous would not make it less of an insult. You'd still be angry and hurt at what I said, whether I said it humorously or not. So, there's humor without relief. Indeed, because of the humor, you might even be angrier because I not only pointed out your flaw, I made light of it. The second example comes from stand-up comedy. Now, there's long been a genre of comedy we call shock comedy. This is where comedians break some cultural rule and generate laughs by saying things we shouldn't say. Consider comedians who use profanity or extreme gratuitous sexual references instead of clever twists of languages to get laughs. Relief theory makes perfect sense of that. More recently, there's an offshoot of this approach called squirm comedy. Here, the comedian doesn't flaunt the rules, but rather acts in such a way that the comedian makes clear that he thinks he's obeying the rules, but is really acting in a way he should realize is wrong, but doesn't. We become embarrassed for him, knowing that he should be embarrassed for himself, but is too obtuse to realize how wrong he's acting. Think of the television program The Office, or early Steve Martin stand-up routines. It's the happy obliviousness of the comedian in saying or doing things that he ought to realize are wrong that makes us all the more uncomfortable. And in that discomfort, the humor is created not by relieving it, but by amplifying it. Just as relief theory was furthered by psychologists, so too it's been undermined by psychologists. The researchers Howard Pollio and Rodney Merce ran an experiment asking people how much they anticipated a punchline and how funny they thought a joke was. Counter to intuition, it turned out that the jokes where people could see the punchline coming in comedic terms where the punchline was telegraphed, were also judged by them to be the funniest. If relief theory were right, this shouldn't have been the case, because seeing it coming meant that the energy isn't built up and waiting to explode. But that's what they discovered when they ran their test. Finally, we could examine concerns with individual versions. Hutchison and Freud fell prey to the progress of science. We no longer buy into their theories of mind, and we saw that their accounts of humor derived from those theories. Lotta's more interesting. His view requires that all humor occurs in his three stages: unrelaxation, cognitive shift, and re-relaxation through laughter. The obvious concern is that we often appreciate humor without laughing. It doesn't mean the joke wasn't humorous simply because I smirked and didn't guffaw. But there's a more interesting problem. Aren't there a number of things we find funny without a cognitive shift? Things that are just funny in themselves? Listen to a baby laugh. We find that incredibly cute and funny. But there's no shift. We're laughing directly at it. And there seems to have been no unrelaxation. We enjoyed it from the first laugh to the last. So, we do not have the relief of having answered the question. So, on we must go.
Tail slate! Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Banana.
Banana who?
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Banana.
Banana who?
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Orange.
Orange who?
Orange, you glad I didn't say banana?
Lecture 14, Incongruity Theory.
So, Steve, we've been telling you our jokes all week. Why don't you tell us one?
Oh, all right. Well, here's one of my favorites. So, the Pope comes to America, right? Here for 2 weeks, you know, masses, meetings, right? Grueling schedule, right? Last day, they're driving him to the airport. And the chauffeur says, "Your Holiness, it's been 2 weeks. This is your last moments in America. Is there anything you'd like to do while you're here?" The Pope says, "You know, I'm always being driven everywhere. I miss driving. Could I drive?" And the chauffeur says, "Hey, no worries." Pulls over. They switch places. Pope's up front, starts tooling around, driving on these backcountry roads, looks in his rearview mirror, and there are the red and blue lights. Pulls over. The policeman gets up, walks to the window. Pope rolls down the window. The cop looks at him. Eyes get wide. Says, "Excuse me for a moment." Runs back to his car, picks up the radio, and says, "Quick, give me the chief. Chief, I'm in a strange situation. I pulled somebody over, and I don't know what to do." He says, "Well, who is it?" He goes, "I don't know. It's somebody important." "Important? What is it, the mayor?" No, more important than that." "The governor?" No, more important." "A senator?" No, more important." "More important? Who is it?" "I don't know, but the Pope is his chauffeur."
Hey, Steve, how you doing? Seriously? We're not hourly. Get back to work. All right, I just want to get rid of him. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Interrupting chicken.
Interrupting. You want the coat and tie?
No, you got it.
Everyone's a comedian. The goal of a theory of humor is to give a complete explication of the notion of humor. That is, set out the set of defining characteristics of what it is for an act to be humorous. If you took a poll of contemporary philosophers of humor, the theory that would be the overwhelming leader in terms of support would be what we call incongruity theory. According to this view, the central concept involved in creating humor is an incongruity. Two things that do not connect with each other, that clash with each other, that do not fit together. We love chocolate, we love cheeseburgers, but we don't love chocolate cheeseburgers. An incongruity theorist would argue that instead of eating them, we will laugh at them. The reason that incongruity theory rules the roost is that it gives an exceptionally good account of how verbal jokes work. Standard verbal jokes are made up of two parts. First is the setup. It's a small story, a set of sentences that give you a mental image of the world it creates. You understand these sentences in a particular way. Let's call this the primary interpretation. You're then given the second part of the joke, the punchline. In the punchline is information that does not make sense in the joke world under the primary interpretation. The brain struggles to figure out how this new information makes sense, but to no avail. There's confusion and bafflement. But then you get the joke. In other words, your brain realizes that there's a second interpretation, what we can call the secondary interpretation. And under the secondary interpretation, we have to understand the setup differently. We have to see the joke world in a new way. But in this new way, the punchline now makes perfect sense. We can toggle back and forth between interpretations and see how they give us different incompatible worlds. Those two worlds are incongruous. We marvel at the incongruity. We appreciate the incongruity. We laugh and enjoy life. The incongruity theorists toast each other and claim philosophical victory. At least, to hear them tell the story. And the story works well in most cases of verbal jokes. Right? Consider the joke in the intro to this lecture. We know the full story. We know the Pope wanted to drive. We know that it's the Pope's limousine and that he moved from the back seat to the front to take the wheel. But when we hear the punchline, we suddenly shift points of view and see the world from the perspective of the police officer who only has limited information. We compare his understanding of the event with our own understanding of it and see the two are incompatible. Appreciating this incongruity, we find humor. Think of many pun-based jokes.
Two cannibals are eating a clown when one turns to the other and says, "Does this taste funny to you?"
There's an incongruity between the two meanings of funny. That's the basis of the joke. Humorous insults.
You so old, your memory in black and white.
The humor is the result of the incongruity generated by comparing two similar things, recorded memory and recorded film from the past and the present. Even Shaggy Dog jokes, where the point is to go on and on and on, and in the end, the punchline isn't even funny. What makes it a joke is the incongruity between the expectation of how a joke is told and the execution of that joke. Advocates of the incongruity approach contend that you can give an effective account of the mechanism which generates the humor of any kind of joke at all. Many of the philosophers who engage seriously in the project of humor theory are analytic philosophers who see philosophy as a linguistic endeavor. We analytic philosophers talk of utterances and speech acts as the basic objects of philosophical inquiry. We're such nerds. And as such, if we want to explain the nature of humor, it will be humorous utterances and speech acts that we take as paradigmatic of humor in general. This is the reason that verbal jokes have become the standard instances of humor that philosophers consider. In a journal article, we can type out a joke and indent it and give it a label, example 2.3. Since these tend to be jokes based on incongruity, incongruity theory has tended to be seen as the most successful and, as often as not, the right answer. This goes all the way back to Immanuel Kant. To many, the fact that Kant wrote on humor is surprising. Kant was, how shall we say it, structured in his life. He lived according to an incredibly rigid schedule. Every day he would take a walk. Every day, the walk was taken in the same exact number of steps. It was said that you could set your clock by Kant passing your door. He was so regular in his pace. His ethical system relies on absolute rules that cannot be broken under any circumstances. Lying is always wrong. If a murderer asks you where the victim is hiding, you must tell the truth. This doesn't seem like the funniest guy, especially if you read his philosophy. But every Saturday, he would hold a luncheon for his fellow intellectuals. Each place was meticulously set and included a neatly written note, which was setting out the afternoon's menu, course by course, and alongside the name of the dish was the topic that was to be conversation engaged in during that part of the meal. Always with dessert, the topic was Witze, jokes. So, Kant liked jokes. In his Critique of Pure Judgment, his book on ethics and aesthetics, he devotes some pages to considering the nature of humor. The key to understanding jokes, according to Kant, is that they say nothing. Usually, speech has content. It conveys a proposition. When we hear a proposition, the mind springs into action. It works to understand the meaning of the proposition and then to judge it. Is it true or false? Is it moral or immoral? Is it beautiful or ugly? When we hear a joke, what happens in the mind is that it struggles with a riddle. It works hard to understand it. The mind finds itself twisted in trying to understand a very complex problem until it suddenly realizes there's no problem at all. It's not a puzzle to be figured out. It turns out to be nothing. Laughter, Kant wrote, is an affection arising from the sudden transformation of a strained expectation into nothing. We realize that the joke is not a proposition. When I tell you the jokes in these lectures, I don't want you to really think that a chicken crossed the road or that the Pope got pulled over. After a joke, you know nothing more than you knew before, except another joke to tell. Jokes, according to Kant, are completely vacuous. And that's what makes them funny. We think at first that the words spoken are meaningful, but then we contrast it with the incongruity of its actual meaninglessness, and therein we have the humor. A different approach to an incongruity account of humor comes from the 20th century French philosopher Henri Bergson. Bergson worried that human life was being denigrated by modern times. The success of science and technology has led humanity to seeing the world through its lens, considering everything, including humans, to be mere machines. People, we've come to think, are just robots. But we aren't. We're living beings, and being alive conveys upon us a special status beyond the scope of anything that could be envisioned by the mechanized scientific worldview. We are animated by an élan vital, a vital impulse, a life force that makes us more than just machines. This distinction between humans and robots, between the organic and the inorganic, Bergson contends, is the heart of humor. We have two different categories, the living and the artificial, or the human and the non-human. When we encounter a situation that mixes these dichotomous categories, that's when we get humor. Humor, Bergson contends, is an essentially human phenomenon. Without people, there would be no humor. Humor comes from a twisting of the human in the lived world. It could be when a human acts like a machine. Think of the famous scene in I Love Lucy in the Chocolate Factory, right? Lucy and Ethel have to wrap chocolates as they come down the line. They start slowly at first and then speed up, with the two able to just barely get them wrapped. This is funny because we've taken two humans, Lucy and Ethel, and turned them into machines. But then the line speeds up, and they're unable to maintain the pace and start stuffing the candy into their mouths, and Lucy starts putting it down the front of her blouse. This is funny on a Bergsonian understanding because now the machine people have suddenly become rehumanized. The machines become people again. We find non-human things that act human funny. When a parrot speaks perfect English, we laugh. When a robot interacts with us just as a person would, we find it funny. Bergson uses the example of the dancing jack, the wooden figure with a string, and when you pull it, the joints move, making it look like it dances. Why is this children's toy a classic? for the same reason we laugh at the fake jar of peanuts with the fabric-wrapped spring inside. It's a non-human thing that acts as if it's alive when it's not. We find people funny when they doggedly adhere to specific ideas, even when the world tells them they should abandon them. Take Jack Benny, for example. Right? His character on radio and television was miserly to the extreme. He was cheap. He hated spending, much less losing money. Right? In one famous episode, he's held up by a gunman who demands his money, saying, "Your money or your life." When Benny doesn't answer, the thug repeats the threat, "Your money or your life." To which Benny replies, "I'm thinking it over." Here, we should clearly prefer the loss of a small amount of money to the loss of one's life. But Benny's complete adherence to his desire for money makes him funny because he's a human acting like a machine. Bergson contends that the soul is light and graceful, but the body is clumsy and comic. When someone slips and falls on a banana peel, or when Laurel and Hardy are trying to move a piano up a hill, what we get is the human foiled by the material environment. The humor is the result of the incongruity between the human will, the desire of a beautiful consciousness, meeting the unforgiving mechanical external world of matter. Bergson gives us a version of the incongruity account where the incongruity is a specific one, human, non-human. Contemporary versions of the incongruity theory have a very different feel. Now, the big name in incongruity theory today is Victor Raskin, right? A linguist at Purdue University who we've mentioned before. His view centers around the idea of a script. Again, the linguist's notion of a script is a concept of meaning that's quite different from the philosopher's notion of explication. Philosophers try to find sets of necessary and sufficient conditions to give a complete account of what's in and what's out of the set of things described by the term. Linguists, on the other hand, contend that meaning arises from clusters of cognitive relations, right? Remember the example of the word chair. Linguists say that if you ask any competent speaker of English if they know what a chair is, those people will say, "Of course I do." If you ask those same people for the set of necessary and sufficient conditions that define a chair, they'll stare at you blankly. Once you explain what it is, virtually none of them, possibly absolutely none of them, could give a complete explication. But they all know what chairs are. They're not confusing tables, shoes, or wildebeests for chairs. If you gave them a test in which you push a red button if a thing is a chair and a blue button if a thing is not a chair, they would get it right every time. So, knowledge of what a chair is not a function of abstract definitions. But if you ask them to describe what a chair is to someone who had never seen a chair before, they would use related words. Sit, seat, legs, back, arms, cushion. Most people would give the same set of these related words. The first words they used would be relevant to most chairs. As they went on, the words would be related but less strongly, perhaps not being essential parts of chairness or true only of a small group of chairs, say beanbag chairs. This interconnected word cloud is what linguists call a script. Take a word for which we're creating a script and put it in a circle. Connected to the circle by lines are circles with other words. The shorter to the line connecting the word circles, the more related the words are. The longer the lines, the less connected the words in the circles are. Words are ambiguous if they have more than one meaning. The word chair is ambiguous. I was the chair of the philosophy department at Gettysburg College. While it may be true that I was a lazy boy while assigned to this administrative duty, I was not a recliner. I said yes to everything, so I wasn't even a decliner. The word chair in that context does not mean something elevated above the floor for sitting upon. Rather, it means chief administrator of an academic department at a college or university. The signifier, C-H-A-I-R, thus is associated with two completely different scripts. Raskin argues that humor, specifically verbal humor, but perhaps all humor, is based on script opposition. That means that what happens in a joke is that the setup leads you to take some operative notion and make sense of it in terms of one script. the punchline that forces you to try to assimilate new knowledge into the primary interpretation in such a way that the script will not allow. But then you realize that you needed to change which script you made use of in understanding the text of the joke. This is easiest to apply in pun-based jokes. Consider a joke told to me by my daughter.
One day, a guy's washing the car with his son, and his son says, "Dad, are you sure we couldn't just use a sponge?"
The script opposition in this case turns on the seemingly innocuous preposition with. If I said X was washing a car with Y, the with could mean one, that Y was another person helping X wash the car, or it could mean two, that X was using Y as an instrument to apply soap to the car. There are two different scripts associated with, and the joke works because we naturally assume script one, but then have to suddenly switch to script two. Take this joke, please.
So this guy walks into the rooftop bar at the Knickerbocker Hotel in New York, sits down, and orders a beer. The drunk sitting next to him looks over and says with slurred speech, "Hey, buddy, I'll bet you $50 I can jump out that window and fly around the building and come back in." Guy says, "You're drunk. It's 14 stories. You'll kill yourself." The drunk says, "That may be true, but I'm going to do it whether you bet or not, so you might as well make the money, right?" And he reaches in the pocket, pulls out a $50 bill, puts it on the bar. The guy thinks about it, shrugs his shoulders, puts another $50 on the bar next to it. Drunk walks over, opens a window, jumps out, flies around the building and back in. He picks up the two $50s, puts them in his pocket. The guy says, "That's amazing. How did you do that?" Drunk says, "I'm an architectural engineer. There are two taller buildings to the east and two taller buildings to the west. During the day, the cement heats up in the evening, and the water is cooler, causing a wind to get funneled up by the taller buildings, causing an updraft that'll support about 350 pounds. Tilt your body, and it takes you right around." "Wow, that's really interesting." Just then, a new guy walks in, sits down. The drunk says, "Now you go get him." "Well, I don't know." "Look," says the drunk, "if you don't, I will, and you're the one who's down 50 bucks." So the guy walks over, says to the new guy, "Hey, buddy, I'll bet you $50 I can jump out that window, fly around the building, and come back in." New guy says, "Yeah, you're drunk. It's 14 stories. You'll kill yourself." Says, "That may be true, but I'm going to do it whether you bet it or not, so you might as well make the money, right?" And he reaches in his pocket, pulls out a $50 bill, puts it on the bar. New guy thinks about it, shrugs his shoulders, puts another $50 on the bar next to it. Our guy walks over, opens the window, and plummets to his death. Bartender looks up at the drunk and says, "You're nasty when you've been drinking, Superman."
In this case, it's a little more difficult. We bring with us to the joke a script for the word drunkard. Connected to drunkards are words like impulsive and irresponsible. So, when he says he's going to jump out the window, this doesn't seem an odd behavior for a drunkard. When he explains his ability not to plummet to his death in terms of architectural engineering, we now associate the scripts drunkard and engineer. Engineer is connected to technical, smart, analytical, and the like. So, we now have a collection of scripts that allow us to understand the situation. Until, that is, the bartender cognitively ruins everything and reveals that the drunkard is Superman. The script for Superman includes fast, strong, and defender of the American way. But one nodule very close to the term is fly. We now change what script we're using and the joke makes sense. Raskin is giving us an incongruity theory in which the incongruity is understood in terms of distinct but associated scripts. There is a reason so many smart people buy into incongruity theory. For so many different verbal jokes, it perfectly accounts for the mechanism which underlies the architecture of the joke. The philosopher Robert Latta argues against the incongruity theory by taking what advocates consider one of the account's great strengths to, in fact, be a fatal flaw, the breadth of the concept of incongruity. Incongruity theorists hold that there are a whole bunch of different types of incongruity that are used in different sorts of jokes. It could be incongruous meanings in a pun-based joke.
What do you do with a dead chemist? You bury him. Because you couldn't helium or curium.
There are incongruities that come from unmet expectations.
How do you determine if a bull has been castrated? very carefully.
In this joke, the setup leads you to believe that what's coming is instructions, not merely advice. There are incongruities that are violations of logic.
What's red and invisible? No tomatoes.
Tomatoes are red, but a lack of them has no properties since it's an empty set. There are incongruities that are ineffective instructions or descriptions that seem to fit unusual situations.
When I was young, I was so skinny when I went to the doctor for x-rays, he would just hold me up to the window.
My friend Dave is so tall, his birthday is July 16th, 17th, and 18th.
Incongruity theorists argue that all of these are easily accounted for by the notion of incongruity. But Lana objects that this makes the concept of incongruity so broad that it loses all meaning. Except for conversations with your spouse, you never know what someone else is going to say to you. So, in a sense, all speech is incongruous. The advocates of this theory do not give a strict definition of incongruity, because if they did, then their view would be too narrow, leaving out some obvious jokes from the concept of humor. But in keeping it so loose, they make it so broad that it fails to do the definitional work it needs to, Lotta argues. Another objection contends that incongruity is not necessary. Some humor not only doesn't contain an incongruity, but contains extreme congruity. Take impersonations. What makes it funny when Rich Little or Frank Caliendo do their act is how much the voice, the pacing, and the mannerisms match the person being impersonated. Here, it seems it's the congruity, not incongruity, that is responsible for the humor. But the major objection most often leveled at incongruity theory is that it's not sufficient. We see incongruous things all the time, right? If one day on your way to work, you witness an automobile accident, one car running a red light and plowing into another, right? Unless you live around Washington, D.C., that's probably an unusual event. It's something you surely didn't expect. It would be incongruous with what you thought you would see on your way to work. But it's not funny. Quite to the contrary, instead of amusement, your reaction would likely be shock and concern for those in the cars. If I spent the entire next lecture repeating the word applesauce for 30 minutes with no explanation, and then in all subsequent lectures, just went on as usual with discussions about philosophy of humor, then that would surely be an incongruous happening. But it would just be weird. I don't think it'd be terribly humorous. If I released a comedy album, Applesauce, by comedian Steve Gimbel, it would likely not sell very well. And rightly so. That's not humor. But it's surely not what you expect from an album. It's incongruous. So, the incongruity theorists need to tell us what it is about certain incongruities and not others that make them humorous. What is the essential element? We'll seize the opportunity to ask that question in the next lecture and see if we can tellurium the truth to you there.
Lecture 15, Cleverness Theory.
Applesauce.
Applesauce.
Applesauce, applesauce.
Applesauce, applesauce, applesauce.
Applesauce?
Applesauce.
Applesauce, applesauce. Applesauce, 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 applesauce. Applesauce, applesauce, applesauce. Applesauce, applesauce, applesauce. Applesauce. Applesauce, applesauce. Applesauce.
Applesauce.
Told you it wasn't going to be that funny.
Aren't you clever?
So far, in this section of the course, we've examined the five major theories of humor. Superiority theory, inferiority theory, play theory, relief theory, and incongruity theory. If you pick up every one of the most important books of the philosophy of humor, these are the five that will be discussed in detail. As we've seen, these five have been around in some form or another for centuries. But there is a new kid on the block, a sixth humor theory that is very recent. It's called the cleverness view. According to this theory, humor is a conspicuous act of playful cleverness. Now, the philosopher who proposed it has not really gotten his due. He's an incredibly insightful thinker who's broken fascinating new ground with this novel approach to humor. And he's quite good looking. Or so my wife says. Yes, this is my contribution to the literature. I have proposed a new theory of humor. Let's see how it works and what its strengths and weaknesses are. At this point in the lecture, I usually give a quick biographical sketch of the philosopher whose work we'll discuss and, you know, tell some of the funny or strange stories about him or her, but we'll dispense with that in case my kids decide to watch or listen to this at some point because I only have so much money put away for them for therapy. I will, however, tell you how I came to have the insight that led to this new approach. It started when I was 39 years old and driving home from work. I was scanning the radio and heard the drive time DJ on the Hard Rock station out of Baltimore say, "After this, we'll be right back with an ethical question." An ethical question? Okay, I thought. You got me. So, the question concerned a gas station out in Indiana. Now, this was right after gas prices for the first time spiked above $3, and the station had mistakenly programmed their pumps to charge 3/100ths of a cent per gallon instead of $3 per gallon. In other words, they were just giving away gas. It took until 5 o'clock in the evening for anyone to tell the station. So the question was whether the customers were morally bound to do so. On the one hand, it was the station's mistake, right? It's not my job to double-check what they do. They can charge whatever they want. If that's what the pump says, that's the price. On the other hand, I pulled into the station, which has the big sign advertising what the price ought to be. When I saw the sign and went to fill up, I tacitly agreed to pay whatever the price would be. So, take it for less, that's a form of stealing. I listened to the discussion on the radio, which was, as you'd expect, not terribly thoughtful. The next day at work, I emailed the producer of the show and said, "I'm a philosopher and would be happy to come on the radio if they wanted to have a better discussion about it." Who knows why the producer emailed me back asking me to come on the air, but he did. So I went on the radio. Now, these people had no idea who I was and scheduled me for just one segment early in the show, likely before the majority of their audience was actually listening. I decided I was going to be completely irreverent on the air. They were expecting a stodgy philosophy professor, but I was going to give them a smart aleck with the accent on smart. Now, the show was fun. They canceled most of what they had planned to put on the air the rest of the afternoon and kept me on for 3 segments. Now, between the second and third segment, the DJ, who had been a staple of the stand-up comedy community around the area for decades, looked at me with eyes narrowed and asked, "Have you ever done stand-up comedy?" I hadn't. I've been a comedy nerd since I found my dad's George Carlin and Alan Sherman records as a kid. Here was a real comedian asking me if I was a member of his tribe. Wow. So when I turned 40, I thought, what have I always wanted to do that I've never done? And the answer was stand-up comedy. So I went to a local comedy club that had an open mic night, brought 30 people, friends, family, colleagues, former students, all there to watch me perform. The rest is a long story, but the short version is that I caught the bug and started performing regularly for about 5 years at places around the Baltimore, Washington area. A few paid gigs, but mostly amateur open mics. I've never been a stand-up comedian, nor would I claim to really have had any success. But I had some really interesting experiences spending time with people who did. It led me to really think about humor. Talking back at the bar with the people who were dedicating their lives to the craft. And what I noticed was that they thought about humor differently than the philosophers did. So I started to think if maybe the philosophers should listen to them. The first thing I noticed from the comedians was that jokes were not limited to the stage. That they would make jokes all the time and most of the time not get laughs. So say if someone's girlfriend was leaving him, you know, a common occurrence for comedians, right? On the one hand, it hurts. On the other hand, it's good for material. They'd often make jokes that were designed to make their new ex feel uncomfortable. It might be insults. It might be woe is me. It might be just odd observational stuff. But it came from a place of pain meant to cause shame or anger or embarrassment in the other person. Laughter, mirth, and amusement were not the goal of these jokes. But knowing their routines as I did, the words were well-formed jokes in their style. They were jokes. So, my humor theory starts from a different place than all of the others. I claim that there is no necessary connection between humor and laughter. Jokes can be used for as many purposes as any other type of utterance and still be jokes. Jokes can be used to tell the truth. Jokes can be used to distract from the truth. Jokes can be told to make yourself superior to someone. Jokes can be used to make yourself inferior to someone. Jokes can be used to make yourself seem more attractive. Jokes can be used to make yourself seem less attractive. Jokes can be used for any purpose. Eliciting laughter may be the most common, but it's far from the only purpose. So, if we have to separate laughter, mirth, and amusement from humor, what then is the point of it? What makes humor humorous? What is humorousness if not the ability to cause laughter? The answer came to me in thinking about the way comedians judged each other's material. They were always incredibly judgmental. But what was interesting is that the jokes they approved of were not always the jokes that got the most laughs from the audience. Indeed, some of the jokes that really killed got the worst responses from the other comics. Now, the comedian's term for a poorly crafted joke is hack. Some of the hack jokes bombed, and some of them killed. My job was to figure out exactly what they meant by the term hack. On reflection, it became clear that was really being judged was how clever the material was. A good joke is clever. This was the trigger for the view I would develop over the next couple of years. The complete view includes four necessary and jointly sufficient elements to account for humor. Humor is an intentional, conspicuous act of playful cleverness. So, we need to understand what's meant by these terms. Intentional, conspicuous, playful, and clever. We'll have to see what comes out when we put them together and then see if this gives us a view that is too broad and or too narrow. Okay, by using the word intentional, I'm contending that humor is a human activity. That is, it's something we choose to do. I consider humor to be an art form. And art is not something that just happens on its own. It's something we must decide we're doing. Just as there's a difference between finding the Grand Canyon to be beautiful and finding a painting of the Grand Canyon to be beautiful, so too, there's a difference between finding something to be funny and finding something to be humorous. When we admire the Grand Canyon itself, we're in awe of its majesty. When we admire a painting of it, we admire the artist's ability to capture those properties. Similarly, I may laugh at my brother slipping on ice and Charlie Chaplin acting like he's slipping on ice. And I may even find them funny for the same reason. But in terms of humor, those are two different actions. The unintentional slipping by my brother is something found funny, where Charlie Chaplin's is a work of art. A humor theory is not a theory of the funny. Rather, it's a theory that concerns a certain sort of intended human activity. The second condition I include is conspicuousness. Something is conspicuous if it's out there to be seen. Humor is a social phenomenon. We tell jokes to have our jokes heard, to have our jokes gotten, to have our jokes admired. Maybe it's to generate laughter. Maybe it's to put someone in his place. Maybe it's to show off in front of someone we want to impress. Maybe it's to inspire someone impressed with us to relax and treat us like normal people. There are many things we can do with a joke, but the joke is out there to accomplish something social. By conspicuous, I don't mean obvious, right? Bad jokes may completely telegraph their punchlines, but that's not what I mean. I just mean that a joke is meant to be gotten. Comedians speak of jokes landing. The image here is an airplane. Either it flies over the audience's head and the audience doesn't get the joke, does not even realize that what you said was a joke, or that it was a joke at all, or it lands. It comes in where it was meant to be. Jokes are a form of communication, and the point of communication is to communicate. I'm a philosopher. I say deep things. But there are different forms of communication. In some cases, again, what linguists call bona fide communication, what you're doing is trying to transfer beliefs. If I tell you that it was sunny last Thursday, what I'm doing is taking something I believe, that it was sunny last Thursday, and through the use of language, I'm trying to get you to have the same belief. But, again, humor is non-bona fide communication. I'm trying to communicate, but not in order to give you any beliefs. Consider the old joke.
There's a pirate with a steering wheel on the front of his pants, and I'm like, what's that for? And he goes, arr! It's driving me nuts.
For the joke to do whatever it was meant to do, we needed to have communicated. But it's not bona fide communication. I do not believe there was ever such a pirate. I don't want you to believe that there was ever such a pirate. It's a different kind of communication. It's non-bona fide communication, or communication not intended to convey information. We often employ non-bona fide communication in artistic contexts, right? When Johnny Cash sings about shooting a man in Reno just to watch him die, we know it's just the lyrics to a song. When an actor playing Hamlet contemplates suicide, we're not genuinely worried about the actor's mental health. In the same way, the conspicuousness of the act of humor comes from it being a work of art. Some may think that including all acts of humor in the class of works of art cheapens the notion of art. Such people are not only wrong, they need to loosen up. Again, we're seeing the equivocation between something being serious in the sense of grave and something being serious in the sense of worth considering in depth. Humor may not be the first, perhaps by definition, but it certainly is the second. Acts of humor are artistic performances, and artistic performances occur on a stage. Now, the stage may be literal or metaphorical. Right? We create artistic spaces because we look at art differently than we look at non-art. Because we're engaging in non-bona fide communications, we judge the act differently. Elements of a piece of literature, for example, may have meaning, foreshadowing, or symboling that similar utterances would not have in normal conversation. As such, when we approach a piece of art, we mentally approach it differently. We set it off from the world and look at it through an aesthetic lens, not a normal interpretive lens. We do this with humor. Think of what we say or how we behave just before telling a joke. Stop me if you've heard this one before. Did you hear the one about the rabbi who played golf on Yom Kippur? So, this lawyer dies, and there he is at the pearly gates. We say certain things or do certain things in order to clearly convey to our audience that it's time to stop our normal conversation in which you hear me as engaging in bona fide communication, wherein you judge what I say using logical and critical tools to determine its likely truth, and instead step out of the normal world into joke world, where you take what I say to be part of an artistic act. When we tell jokes, we create a special space, a sort of informal stage for us to perform the joke upon. The philosopher William Fry called this created joke stage the play frame. When we joke, we take our conversation out of the normal realm and insert it and ourselves into a play frame. When we make use of joke introductions like, did you hear the one about, we make it clear that we're entering the play frame. But in other cases, the audience might not know they are, in fact, in the play frame. This is essential for certain sorts of humor. Consider practical jokes. If your friend knows that you've inserted a bouillon cube in her shower head, then the joke won't work. Think of the old television program Candid Camera. The fun of the show was that the mark was walking into a play frame completely unaware. One of the best parts of the show was when the mark was let in on the fact that he was experiencing not something in the real world, but something in a play frame. Right? In one of the classics, a car with no engine was drifted into a gas station. This was back in the days when all gas stations were full service and the attendants would check your oil. The driver popped the hood and the service station attendant looked in and saw that the car had no engine. But it had just driven into the gas station. The driver, of course, played dumb, and the gas station attendant was left trying to make sense of something that couldn't possibly be true. Being in on the joke, we watched from the outside and laughed at the poor man. But we laughed even more when Alan Funt walked over, pointed to the hidden camera and said, "Smile, you're on candid camera." At that point, it was exposed that he had, unbeknownst to him, been in a play frame. So, jokes are works of art that require, one, that they're intentional. We need to make art for it to be art. Two, they need to be conspicuous. The point of making art is to have it experienced by someone else. Humor occurs when we set up a play frame and do something inside. But what? The third condition is playfulness. Now, this seems at first like I'm proposing a sort of play theory type model. But what I mean by the notion of play is different from what play theorists mean. I don't mean playfulness as in lightheartedness or silliness. Rather, I'm invoking the sense of play that we use when we tell a child to stop playing with her food. To play with your food is not to have fun with it, but to use it for something other than that for which it was intended. Right? When I hold a banana up to my ear and pretend it's a telephone or hold it straight out as if it were a gun, then I'm playing with the banana because this is not what bananas are for. When I twist a concept or use a word that's ambiguous to create a pun, what I'm doing is playing with ideas and playing with words. This is the sort of play that I mean. Now, in order for you to know that I'm playing with something, you would have to know what that thing was supposed to be used for. Here's where joking can be contextual. It's never subjective whether I am in fact joking. I'm either engaging in bona fide or non-bona fide communication. But my joke may completely fail to land because you have no idea what the thing I'm playing with is actually supposed to be for. Take this joke, for example.
Did you hear about the quantum mechanical nightclub? It's called the H-Bar.
The form of the utterance tips you off that it's a joke. But if you have no background in quantum mechanics, you will not know why it's a joke. H is the letter we use to represent Planck's constant, a number that appears in many equations of quantum mechanics. For computational reasons, we have to divide H by 2 pi a lot. And so we abbreviate H over 2 pi as H bar. Anyone who's undertaken any studies of quantum physics will have said H bar many times. And so to twist the meaning from Planck's constant divided by 2 pi to the name of a drinking establishment is to play with something in a way that most people will not realize. But it is play. A joke that doesn't land is a failed joke, but failed jokes are still jokes. So, humor is playing with something in a play frame. But there are a number of ways we can play with things. The key to humor is that it is being played with in a way that demonstrates cleverness. Cleverness really is the heart of what it is to be humorous. When the comedians I was hanging out with in the bar watching the routines of the other comedians would laud or pan a joke, what they were really evaluating was how clever the joke was. Now, any philosopher worth her salt would immediately reply, "Okay, but what do you mean by the word clever?" There are, of course, lots of ways of being clever. What they all have in common, I want to argue, is that they all demonstrate a cognitive virtue. Okay, a cognitive virtue is any property of mind that could be advantageous in some situation in the real world. Being able to see things from multiple perspectives is a cognitive virtue. Being well-read is a cognitive virtue. Being quick-witted is a cognitive virtue. Being able to draw connections between seemingly unconnected things is a cognitive virtue. Being rigorously logical is a cognitive virtue.